Hang on. The sun's up, and it's not Friday.
It's early. Damn early.
Must mean that you're on Community Radio 3CR for Saturday Kick-Ons with Jacob and Mercedes.
Hi there.
Oh, the pillars of society cruise down the road each day. They got the economic wherewithal. We can't afford to pay.
If Friday night's rave wasn't enough for you, we've got an hour-long summer special where you can listen to us for the next hour from 9 till 10 a.m.
There's a hierarchy of dominance with a power at the top. And if you think you found the magic key, you find they changed the locks. The pillars of society drive us like a tool. For them, that's cool.
So if you're a regular Asia Pacific Currents listener, you know who we are. Stay tuned. Welcome to 3CR, a Friday rave, Saturday kick-ons. Mercedes and I can usually be heard at 5 p.m. on Fridays, analysing and, quite frankly, bemoaning the current state of the world. But as a special treat, or perhaps more of a penance, as part of 3CR's summer scheduling, we've been asked to take over the time slots of Asia Pacific Currents and Palestine Remembered while both Giselle and NASA are on well-deserved breaks. This show will be podcast on Friday Rave's usual podcast stream. So while you're there, check out our usual show. Now, we need to put in the usual disclaimer here. We're pre-recording this show on Wednesday morning, so if the world has turned even crazier in the last few days and we don't mention it, that's why. You're listening on Community Radio 3CR, broadcasting out of Melbourne on 855 kilohertz. As well as on your old school AM radio dial. You can hear us via all the W's on 3cr.org.au, by 3CR Digital, your favourite podcast client, or through your state-of-the-art surveillance helicopter in the sky. We're joined today by a semi-regular guest on a Friday rave, Clinton Fernandez. And Clinton is a professor of International and Political Studies in the Future Operations Research Group at the University of New South Wales. He co-founded the Indo-Pacific Studies Program at University of New South Wales and is a former intelligence officer in the Australian Army. We like to call him the outsider's insider. Clinton, welcome back to 3CR.
Thank you, Jacob. I appreciate that epithet you've just given me. Actually, you gave it to me in 2018 when I wrote a book. Dispute one thing with you. I'm not semi-regular. You only bring me in every 2 years when I write a book. Why am I not on more often?
I'm going to hold you to that. I'm going to hold you to that, brother. And he has written a book. And let's start with the book. You've mentioned it, and I'm holding it up to the screen so people can look at their radio dial and see it. It's called Turbulence, Australian Foreign Policy in the Trump Era. Now, Clinton, I want to one point I want to make, even with the title of it, Turbulence is fair enough, but we are in a Trump era, but it's an era. How is the Trump era defined differently to how it has been, to the Biden era or the Trump one era or the Bush era or the Obama era?
Righto. The Biden era was characterized by what it itself called a foreign policy for the middle class. That's because when Trump had his first term, he comprehensively beat the establishment, whether that's the Republican establishment or the Democratic establishment. He cleaned out people like the Bush dynasty, and all the other establishment figures that had competed in the primaries. And then he defeated Hillary Clinton in the Electoral College votes. And so it resulted in a serious rethinking as to what had gone wrong for this guy who'd never so much as stood for, you know, a local councilman to suddenly become president of the United States. And it was pretty clear that the overwhelming majority of the congressional districts and the other electoral districts that voted for Trump were the ones that had suffered the most from manufacturing losses, job losses from manufacturing going to China. There are empirical studies showing that that's exactly, that it correlates very closely. Mm. And so there were people in the Hillary Clinton camp who moved on to the Biden team. people like Jake Sullivan later became known as the national security advisor to Biden, Anthony Blinken, Secretary of State. So many of these people began rethinking what a democratic foreign policy should look like, and they decided to call it a foreign policy for the middle class. So they wanted to bring in things like a green energy transition, reduce the cost of living, try and produce better jobs. And that was neutered in the US Senate by Democrats because the Republicans are actually not a political party and have not been a political party for about maybe, I would say, well, since around 2008, 2010. They are actually an insurgency. I mean that. A normal political party will debate policies, and yes, they'll vote yes or no or whatever. But their aim since the Obama era has been to make Democratic administrations ungovernable and unworkable by blanketly opposing anything that's proposed, relying on the Democrats to get all 50 members of its senators, to out of the 100 to try and get their legislation in. So the Republican Party stopped being a normal political party and became an insurgency devoted to blocking the opponent's initiatives. That's the conclusion of a man called Norman Ornstein of the conservative, I think, American Heritage Institute. He called them the an insurgency. They were forced, the Biden team was forced to rely on its own senators, and they couldn't get people like Joe Manchin, who was heavily funded by coal interests, or Kyrsten Sinema from Arizona. And so they couldn't get their full program in, as a result of which they made a lot of concessions to the national security state. In any case, the Biden foreign policy for the middle class failed because it discounted the level of inflation and how much discomfort it was causing ordinary Americans. And then when the Russian invasion of Ukraine occurred, and then the sanctions program began, the attempt to cut off Russian oil, well, it just drove the price of goods and and services throughout the West up.
But that was indicative even before Trump. I remember, for example, in the first Trump election or in the lead up to the first Trump election, there was Michelle Obama was campaigning for Hillary Clinton, and she made that what I consider to be a gaffe, where she said, "How dare Trump say, 'Make America great again?' America's already great." And the middle classes and the working classes are going, "What do you mean it's great?"
That's right. Because
No connection with the middle class.
no, they have no connection whatsoever. I mean, Trump actually was articulating the anger and fury, but he's a kind of a showman and a con man. He is entertaining to listen to. He is also a master of distraction. Okay. I mean this very literally. Basically, what he's trying to do, he's playing at two levels. The core idea of a Trump agenda is to balance identity and interests. The interests are the economic interests of the billionaires who have put him into power by funding his election campaign. The identity is the identity of an America of the 1950s before the democratic upheavals of the 1960s. The core elements of his base are white Protestant evangelical Christians and conservatives, people who are committed, let us say, to order over disorder, or what other people might call order over justice. Right? And so by abusing with words Hispanics, Mexicans, foreigners, etc., he is reinforcing the fear, the anger, the hurt felt by the white working class that has been abandoned by the Democrats and the Republicans since the Reagan era. In fact, since the late Carter era of global of neoliberal globalization. And so he's articulating their anger, and he is making a spectacle of sending immigration agents into certain communities to raid and get them kicked out of the country. And that is all deliberate. The gratuitous cruelty and the pettiness is part of the whole identity issue, because it makes people who've been neglected and who felt the pain and who've had opioid addictions and have not been able to see a decent future for their families, they get the visceral thrill and the satisfaction of seeing other people suffer. And so he's playing to their identity, and he says one in the first term, he said one crazy thing after another in order to attract the attention of the press. Meanwhile, in the background, the wrecking crew was dismantling the aspects of the government bureaucracy that actually helped working class Americans. And in the second term, he's doing exactly the same thing, except more so. So the core of a Trump agenda at home is to play on the identity of the base, the people he needs to vote for him, while advancing the interests of the billionaire class that is in the oil industry, the nuclear industry, the crypto industry, and the finance sector and the technology sector, the high-tech sector, that have actually funded his election campaign. Now, at home, he is trying to lock in this minority rule because he, you can't win elections by advancing the interests of the billionaires. You have to do things that make the ordinary people actually come and vote for you. So he's trying to throw them a sop, throw this a bit of red meat by showing them images of foreigners and immigrants and so on being expelled and being rounded up. But he has to advance the interests of the people that actually put him into power. So at home, that's the agenda. Abroad, it's a version of the same thing. So just as at home, he's trying to have minority rule, whereby he wants to dismantle the constitutional checks and balances and the separation of powers, the separation between church and state. He wants to weaken that. But abroad, what he wants to do is set up a what I would call a reactionary international or an illiberal international, a reactionary states composed of countries whose democratic systems either don't exist or have been hollowed out, and they are led by autocrats who will provide that stability for this reactionary international. The Republican Party is, in a way, doing what 100 years ago the Communist Party, the Soviet Union, was doing: set up a communist international, a Comintern. These guys are trying to set up a reactionary international.
The strongman syndrome.
And so that's what he's trying to do. And you can see that not just in the Middle East, but these Arab monarchies that he protects, the Kuwaiti royal family, the Emirati royal families, the Saudi Arabian royal family, Qatar, Bahrain, all of those, but even in the Western Hemisphere and in Eastern Europe. So he likes the idea of an illiberal democracy, which is the explicit political program of Hungary's Viktor Orban.
Now, on that, there's a lot about Trump, but I think what I want to come back to is the concept that it's not just about the personality politics. Like, there's
Yes.
a lot of people's, by I agree Trump is different, and I understand that, of course, but I think there's a danger sometimes by focusing on Trump, where a large part of the mainstream left in the United States and even here in Australia. The attitude we're taking is all the problems of the world are caused by this crazy bloke in Washington. If only we got rid of Trump and had whoever, Kamala Harris. I mean, there was a great banner at the No Kings protest happened last year. It had, if Kamala had won, we'd all be having brunch right now, which is sort of like it's a. It's trying to put it all on the Trump personality, and I guess writing off the concept that, as we say, as we've said on a Friday rave, the fundamental project of the ruling class is the accumulation of more and more and more of the world's wealth into fewer and fewer hands. Whether that's happened in a Biden-esque sort of way or a Trumpian sort of way, I think we want to point out that the overall capitalist project continues.
Well, Trump is well suited for these times. What I mean is, the promise of growth, of globalization, has now ended. Right? And so they need the United States as a state now has produced an agenda of whom Trump is the exponent and the creator. I would say a co-creator, along with the people that have put him into power. And that is the promise of globalization, of capital, finance, manufacturing, et cetera, being able to move across borders. All of those things has now failed. It failed in the global financial crisis, and it has shown that the normal program of neoliberal capitalism is exhausted. The pandemic, in fact, was the historic 40-year crisis of that form of neoliberal globalization, neoliberal capitalism. And so what's needed now is a reset. Biden had tried to do the reset, and in fact, he did talk about the end of the current world order, and we need to build another order that might last another 50 to 80 years. But Trump is the man to try and actually bring it about. I don't think he'll succeed, but that is what he's trying to do. But it is in the interests of the state corporate system of the United States. The current system of international law, in fact, bars much of American foreign policy. And so when Trump is acting lawlessly, it is because he wants to have a new system of laws and norms that effectively give the United States a veto and the ability to reshape world order. And so it is an attempt to hold back the most important project, economic project in the world of the last 10 years, which is the economic integration of the Eurasian continent, right? That's the core thing. Trump is trying to subordinate the advanced industrial powers of France, Germany, the Netherlands, even the United Kingdom, make them insignificant, but promote the Eastern European states, such as Poland and the Baltic states, because they have a greater sympathy to his agenda. He wants to end the system whereby Europe, in particular, the German manufacturing machine, would rely on cheap Russian gas and an expanding Chinese market. If that had continued, it would have led to the economic integration of Eurasia. There would still be political, nation states and so on, but economically, the Eurasian continent would be united, integrated between the Western extremity, namely Britain, and the Eastern extremity, namely China slash Japan and Russia. And what he's managed to do is effectively halt that integration. Now, I don't know how long that's going to last either, because I don't know how long Europe will accept its subordination. But it is clear that that somebody with the personality of a Biden or a Harris or somebody else would not possess the crudeness and the sheer front needed to drive that agenda forward. Trump is therefore a man for the times, and he is a political giant. Okay, to say that is not to approve or disapprove. It is to state the fact. He has subordinated the party of Abraham Lincoln. He has converted the United States Congress into what's been jokingly called the Duma. Like the Russian parliament is effectively a rubber stamp for the Putin clique. And so the US Congress has now turned into effectively a rubber stamp for the Trump clique. And so someone like a Harris or a Biden, or people who paid lip service to norms and laws, would have been completely inappropriate to drive that agenda forward. Someone like Trump, with his open disdain for such norms and rules, is in fact the right person to drive that agenda forward. His brute,
Exactly.
his bullishness and brutishness and so on is precisely the point.
Exactly. And I remember in his first term when Mad Dog Mattis, Jim Mattis, his Secretary of Defense at the time, it's war now, of course, but Secretary of Defense, when he resigned, his complaint about Trump, he said, "This guy doesn't even pretend to care."
Right. And
And
that's the point. That's the
that's
point.
the
Yeah.
point. He
Yeah.
doesn't pretend to care.
And there's another thing which I should bring up, though, which is that the structural basis finds its equivalent in another aspect, and that is the character of the current American elite. Okay, in the past, I'm talking about since the 1870s, 1880s, 1890s, up until the early 2000s, that elite was. Well, at least the 1970s, but and less so up until the early 2000s, that elite kind of went to similar types of schools, were employed in similar law firms, think tanks, and so on. But they also cared about their country enough to fund it. They would try to minimize their tax, but they would fund libraries, universities, museums, institutions of culture, and they had a long-term vision for the kind of America that they wanted. It would still be an imperial America, but the ruling class, or I hate those terms actually. I prefer just the elite investor coalition that actually chooses candidates and so on. Those are the people that actually did think about metaphorically planting trees in whose shade their grandchildren would sit, even if they would never see those trees. But the current ruling class basically are degenerate, and Trump is an expression of that. So they are happy to sell non-fungible tokens and digital, casino-type cryptocurrencies while there is great insecurity and housing unaffordability among the American population. They don't think so much about building museums and so on for the future, but about going to Mars, going to space. And so they are degenerate, and Trump is an expression of that degeneracy.
And I think that goes, you talk about what was that term you used, the elite,
Decadent? The elite investor coalition.
the coalition of the elite, and they're coming from a slightly different space as well. Like when the middle of the 20th century, they were largely oil and resource and manufacturing, and to some extent transport, going back in time,
Yes.
and the Vandenberg type situation. But now we've got people like Elon Musk, Peter Thiel, and those kind of thing, where the very product to reflect their interest, as you say, they're not planting trees for their grandchildren to sit under or building museums. Their very product is ephemeral in nature.
Yes. Yeah. So these people are. I'm going to avoid personalities because we're talking about. If the people you mentioned, Thiel and Musk and so on, didn't exist, they'd be replaced by somebody else. And of course, I know you know that too.
But that class
So,
of that type of person.
yes. So their focus is intensely short term. Their time horizon may be long term, but it benefits themselves. And it is not concerned at all with protecting the country for their descendants, but rather buying a bunker in New Zealand,
Well,
going and establishing something else in space. Sorry, Mercedes.
or instead of buying a bunker or protecting the country for the future, but I feel like a lot of the economic principles in terms of getting control of resources and assets for the long term in a long term projection is actually just looking at future market capitalization and the potential of it for the present. So the forward projection is actually how to financialize and capitalize on the resources and the control of assets.
Yeah, it's also funny money, it's being generated by massive infusions from the United States Federal Reserve. Let me explain what I mean. The Federal Reserve system is required to increase or control the money supply into the United States. They can actually create money out of thin air. That's their role. And they were established in 1913. From 1913 until, let's say, the global financial crisis of 2008, right? So about 100 years, the Federal Reserve increased the supply of dollars in the United States system by about $1 trillion. So, okay, 100 years, $1 trillion. Since 2008, the Federal Reserve, because they can't tax the billionaires, so they can't generate money by taxation, so they've just been increasing the money supply. And as a result, they've printed more than $1 trillion during the global financial crisis. So they expanded the money supply within a few months by the same amount that it took them 100 years to expand. And then during the pandemic, they did it again and again and again. So what you've got now is a lot of money chasing assets to invest in, because people who with money can only do things with it by lending it to somebody else who can then sell it, produce things and then sell it to other people. Right. Otherwise, money in itself, you have to use it for something else. And so what they've turned into is cryptocurrency, fintech, financial technology, which is more finance than technology, crazy ideas such as digital tokens, all of those things, which are kind of glorified Ponzi schemes. And that is the nature of the elite investor coalition whose interests are pursued in the US electoral system now. In modern terms, the difference between the ruling class and the governing class, basically.
Okay, sorry, I just want to get back to
Yeah.
the book, as again I'm saying to the listener, I'm holding it up to the camera here so you can see which book I'm talking about. It's Australian foreign policy. I want to get to the point of talking about Australian foreign policy. One question I want to ask you is, some years ago you did some research about the top 20 companies in the ASX
Yes.
and about how they represented 50% of the market actualization of the Australian dollar and how they were controlled by United States hedge funds. Has that situation changed at all since in the last 7 years?
The extent of portfolio control of the Australian Stock Exchange hasn't changed, except maybe slightly more so. Let me explain what I'm talking about. The stock exchange, there's about 3,000 companies on the stock exchange, in the Australian Stock Exchange. They are different sizes, of course, and the top 20 largest companies on the Australian Stock Exchange are the control about 47% of the entire value of the stock exchange. So the top 20 companies amount to about half the capital, half the money in the entire stock exchange is just 20 companies. Out of those 20 companies, the majority of them are owned mostly by American investors, not by Australian investors. So according to the Bloomberg Financial Professional Terminal, and according to, I'm relying more on evidence submitted to the Australian Parliament during inquiries into foreign ownership now, that's my source. The big Australian BHP is not actually Australian owned. It is about 61 to 71% American owned. The Commonwealth Bank, Westpac Bank, National Australia Bank, ANZ Bank, the number of American investors, the amount owned of shares owned by American portfolio investors exceeds the amount owned by Australian portfolio investors. So they exert a dominant force on the direction of the country, because Australian foreign policy, like any country's foreign policy, is the external expression of a country's domestic character as it interacts with the international environment. Okay, let me quote from the best explainer of Australian foreign policy to ever become Australian Foreign Minister. Paul Hasluck is the person I'm referring to. Hasluck asked this question and answered it. He asked in 1967, why do we have a foreign policy? Why does any country have a foreign policy? It's a very important question. Why do you bother having a foreign policy? His answer was, we have a foreign policy in order to implement our domestic policy. Okay. Any country has a foreign policy in order to implement its domestic policy. And the domestic policy reflects the character of the country. So we are a wealthy country which attracts immigrants from all over the world. We are also an economically dependent country because our exports are primarily what a third world country would export: beef, wheat, iron ore, coal, a bit of tourism, but that's what you can get in Bali as well, and education. Okay, so that's the only difference. Other than that, we retain the economic profile of a developing country. We have a simple economy, but we are a wealthy country. And therefore, if you think about Australia as a suburb of the Anglosphere countries, it's a province, actually. It's a province of a wider Anglosphere. The goal of our foreign policy is to remain wealthy but dependent. It is to demonstrate our relevance militarily and demonstrate our relevance economically to the United States and the people that own the country's economy. So we demonstrate our relevance economically by ensuring that we do not set up a national critical minerals company, but rather we carve up our resources, ship them north, and then buy the proceeds, buy the smart vehicles. We ship off the rare earths, the lithium, all of the things needed for the high energy transition, and then we let other people manufacture them, and then we buy the proceeds, right? So in
And
other
just
words,
on that, Clinton, sorry,
yes.
critical minerals is a thing that we've spoken about quite a lot on the show. As listeners will know, Australia has signed a deal on critical minerals with the US. And also, that kind of comes quite soon after the US signed the, I think it was the $8 billion deal with Saudi Arabia in regards to defense and also critical mineral supplies.
Yes.
And I think it's an $8.5 billion cachet, I guess, of rare earth and critical minerals,
Yes.
of shoring up and securing these supply chains. Now, the US Department of War is also funding production and refineries both in Saudi Arabia, in a and buying up large parts and financial surety in the largest rare earths refinery and processing facility called MP Minerals or MP
Yes.
Materials. And also funding projects here in Australia for refineries. Now, coming back to the book, we talk about oil, and even though, as you know, I'd like to hear your thoughts on critical minerals as an expansive market area in terms of whether it's just having control of assets or potential supply rather than overt continued production as a bargaining chip.
Okay. In 2013, Geoscience Australia did a study called Critical Commodities for a High-Tech World. It looked at the kinds of minerals, metals, etc., that actually are needed for the high-tech economy. And it wanted to know, well, how much of these does Australia have? Where are these things located? It found out, after extensive study, that Australia is extremely wealthy. Well endowed when it comes to critical commodities. So the rare earths, what I'm referring to are commodities in elements in the periodic table that have characteristics that allow them to bind very, very tightly, even under conditions of high heat and high pressure. And they allow them the manufacture of magnets, which can be used in electric cars, in fighter aircraft, in normal commercial aircraft, all of those things. Now, Australia is extremely rich in them. We could, if we wanted to, set up a national critical minerals company. Okay. And then we can invite foreign companies to share their know-how, their technical know-how with us, but to ensure that we climb up the value chain as well. That is an option that we could do.
But
We
instead,
don't have.
you've got the Critical Minerals Fund,
Facilitation office. We have a
Facilitation
critical,
Office.
right. So the Critical Minerals Facilitation Office is not at all based is not based on any attempt at national sovereignty. It is an attempt to show the European Union and the United States where the critical minerals are, so that they can come and carve them up, and we will then sell them at quarry prices, right? And that's why the ambition of our leaders is for Australia to be a better mine, a better quarry, a better farm, and a better gas well. In other words, in order to demonstrate our relevance to the American Imperial Project, we want to make sure that gas that's taken out of the Northwest Shelf of Australia, liquefied natural gas, is sold to Japan at a cheaper price than Australian consumers. And then Japan on-sells the gas to its own customers. Right? And all of that was defended by the resources minister, our resources minister.
Madeline King.
Madeleine King, yes, in the Financial Review, as this is what shows our this is how we can speak with relevance to our partners, or words to that effect. Now, that's a very important statement. It was said in the Financial Review at a major conference, and it's because by demonstrating our relevance militarily to the United States and economically to the United States and its allies, the people that own and run our companies get a better hearing in New York, in Washington, D.C., you see? And so we can't have an independent foreign policy when you have a dependent economy, when you have a dependent ideology, when you've been told, when our children have grown up for the last 15, 20 years, being told that words like so-called Australia, right? That Australia is somehow, in some fashion, because of its original sins, is somehow illegitimate. People think that if people think, especially young people, that the best ideas come from somewhere else, that our own country has nothing positive to offer, they will always think that, well, we really have no option other than to go along with it. So that economic dependence and intellectual dependence. The foreign policy that we have, a dependent foreign policy, is the external expression of those domestic features. You can't just conjure up a foreign policy and just decide we're going to do it. Our neighbor Indonesia, for example, cannot suddenly conjure up a foreign policy and decide it's going to become a Christian nation. It's not. It can't possibly do that.
Yeah.
East Timor, right in the middle of the Indonesian archipelago, the Democratic Republic of Timor-Leste, can't decide it's suddenly going to change some other aspect. Its external relations are a feature, are in fact the external expression of its domestic character, and Australia is no different to that.
And you're tuned to Saturday Kick-Ons on Community Radio 3CR with me, Mercedes and Jacob, and we're talking to Clinton Fernandez, author of Island off the Coast of Asia, Sub-Imperial Power, and his most recent book, Turbulence, Australian Foreign Policy in the Trump Era. Make sure to keep it locked on Community Radio 3CR at 8:55 a.m.
An Australian's domestic character, the United States, I mean, you talked about us being a simple economic country. I think on a scale of economic complexity, we're on a par with countries like
Kazakhstan, Cambodia, and so on. Yes,
Zambia, that kind of thing. Yeah. And
I just say that people should look up the Atlas of Economic Complexity. You'll find it online, very easy to get to, and you'll see the country rankings. We are about 109 out of 170 countries. We are between Saudi Arabia and the Ivory Coast. Well, Saudi Arabia just does petrol,
Yeah.
and the Ivory Coast does cocoa. You know, when you have Belgian chocolates.
Yeah.
There aren't any cocoa plantations in
Yeah.
Belgium.
Yeah. And that tells me something because I haven't looked at that index for a couple of years now. And the last time I did mention it on this radio program, I think I was saying we were number 97th or
No,
98th.
we've gone even worse since then.
So we've gone even worse
Yeah, and
in.
that is the success of Australian foreign policy. Okay, the policy, our foreign and trade policies are succeeding in the interests of those for whom it was designed.
Yes. So how do we bring that to AUKUS? I want to
Well,
talk
it's part of demonstrating relevance, yeah.
in your book, and we haven't got that long left on the show, but you talk about three front lines. You call the European front line, Middle East front line, and the China front line, which talks about, I guess, the relationship with the United States and how the United States is working the levers or
Yes.
attempting to work the levers for its own benefit in those three areas.
Yes.
And then Australia being a AUKUS, of course, and regular listeners will know AUKUS is a topic which is, if not very dear, very near to our hearts here on a Friday rave. Can you just like
Yeah, sure. AUKUS
with
should be
AUKUS?
understood. The AUKUS is named very correctly. It is three nouns in search of a verb. Okay? It is Australia, United Kingdom, United States, and that's it. They're just nouns. It doesn't tell you, there's no adjectives, there's no verbs, nothing. And so it is three nouns in search of a verb. Very, very appropriate because it is basically an attempt to demonstrate relevance in this case by buying, by actually pretending to buy American submarines, in fact, subsidizing the US Navy's submarine budget, right? But it is part of a wider issue of demonstrating relevance, whether by inviting American companies to come to Australia, carve up our resources, ship them north, and we buy the proceeds, or by ensuring interoperability, whereby the role of the Royal Australian Air Force is in fact to be a wing, an air wing of the United States Air Force. The role of the Royal
Wingman,
Australian,
the loyal wingman.
the role of the Royal Australian Navy is to be a squadron of the United States Navy, and the role of Australia itself as a continent is to be a forward operating base for the U.S. Navy. The most important development of the entire associated projects is what's called Submarine Rotation Force West, the base that is going to happen in Cockburn Sound near Fremantle, on the west coast of Australia. It is deliberately misleadingly portrayed as a kind of an advance positioning training base so that Australia can train on American submarines, nuclear powered submarines, until our own AUKUS nuclear-powered submarines arrive. That's not correct. In fact, Submarine Rotation Force West has no connection to AUKUS. It would happen if the submarines never arrived. Submarine Rotation Force West is a forward operational deployment of the United States Navy. It is integrated with the rest of the American presence in the Indian Ocean, because its role will be to go north and close off the Malacca Strait in the Indonesian and Malay archipelagos to Chinese vessels when they bring their oil or food from the Middle East or from Africa across the long Indian Ocean transit and try to get to China. It is basically an attempt to possess the ability to choke off China. And that strangulation is what AUKUS is about. It's also what Submarine Rotation Force West is allowed to, is about. And it has occurred without any kind of political debate or anything like that. It's portrayed as a kind of down payment or some kind of a training base until our boats arrive. It is not. It is completely independent of AUKUS. It is a forward operational base of the United States Navy.
And the same could to some extent be talked about recent additions to Tyndall Base
Yes,
at
in the
Katherine
Northern Territory, yes. So
and
the building of massive construction has been going on, billions, in order to set up fuel depots, runways, all of which design so that in the event of a war in the Western Pacific, in the South China Sea, to cut off China, both in the Indian Ocean and in the South China Sea, American planes and ships, and of course their troops, will be able to conduct their operations by basing themselves in Australia, which is much more secure than, say, Japan or South Korea. Japan is only about 70 nautical miles away, if you're looking at the closest island, Yonaguni, from Taiwan, right? And any American submarine that is trying to operate in the Taiwan Strait or in the South China Sea, if it fires its torpedoes, it has to go back to Japan to reload those torpedoes.
Yes.
Right? And if Japan allows that to happen, it itself could get targeted. So where does the United States then go? Well, it goes to Australia.
Yeah.
Right? And so we are demonstrating our relevance. Our policymakers are well aware that it increases the risk to us, but that's not their primary concern. Their primary concern is that if they don't demonstrate relevance, the United States won't think about us as well as frequently as they would like it to.
But I mean, looking at the national security strategy that the US has recently released, I mean, Australia is kind of, I'm sure it will be to much dismay of policymakers to see that Australia kind of doesn't even really cop a mention in terms of any or much strategic importance except alongside other countries that are considered allies.
Yes, that's right. And therefore, the lesson that will be learned is we need to do more. We need to do even more to be relevant, to continue to be relevant. The national security strategy, by the way, is only for 2025. Okay, it'll change. I mean, the whole idea is really to stop the economic integration of Eurasia and to contain China, to stop China from developing. Because look, the fact is, it's a one-party state, but in many respects, the reason it's attractive is that it's not trying to export its political system to any other country. When it talks about socialism with Chinese characteristics, they mean it quite literally in that they say that you can't actually copy our model. Not only do we not have any interest in imposing it on you, if you're a small Pacific Island country, you can't copy our model. You've got to find your own solution to modernity. And their attraction is that despite the fact that they don't allow political competition, they're a one-party state and so on, at least in the political system, there are actually nine political parties in China, nine legal parties. They've managed to develop without colonialism, war, or slavery. Okay? And that way of developing, where they've come from, China in the 1940s was a sick man of Asia. You would regard it the way you'd regard many Arabian countries today, plagued by wars, warlords, famine, all of those things. And when the Chinese Communist Party won, yes, it was authoritarian and so on, but without that vehicle of modernization, China would not have been able to develop without any war, colonialism, or slavery. And that is an attractive model to other countries that believe in a kind of repressive developmentalism. And so the whole idea of the national security strategy is to shatter that.
And I think in terms of looking at, I guess I'm just drawing a parallel to what you were talking about earlier in the show of the creation of in the press of the spectacle of targeting immigrant populations and ICE and deportations as such in order to bolster support for Trump in what would be a large voter base, but in terms of undermining Eurasian consolidation, in part of that strategy, it is cultivating resistance to Europe's current trajectory. And so, do you see that? I mean, to me, that draws a parallel in terms of using the same devices in the US that Trump used, and then try to, for want of, interfere in such a way by bolstering kind of more patriotic European countries.
Oh yes, the whole idea of a reactionary international is to set up this reactionary international inside the United States, right? By hollowing out the structures of American democracy, but by promoting such parties in Europe. So in his first term, Trump was an open supporter of Nigel Farage and Brexit and other Eurosceptic parties, right? Other forces. So he wants to. He and his vice president, J.D. Vance, want to promote the alternative for a Deutschland, for Germany, in a party, the National Front in France, and other similar countries, in an illiberal international, because they are more, he believes, they are more attuned to his vision. But he wants to weaken them by cutting off their sources of energy. So, for example, when you impose sanctions on Russia, you deny the European manufacturing industries, a cheap source of energy supply. You've weakened Germany. Just consider the German economic system. They have, strong unions. Some of their workers have seats on the board, and they produce cars that are of good quality: Mercedes, Volkswagen, Porsche. You can think of the other cars, German brands. And so they were able to do that with a compact between a boss and worker by getting cheap Russian energy, a large Chinese market. And when you sanction Russia and you tell the Germans you can't buy oil from gas from Russia either, you cut off that you've made energy more expensive. It's harder for them to manufacture things. When they overthrew Libya, that was one source of oil of gas that was going to Europe. When they sanctioned Iran, that's another source of gas going to Europe. When you sanction Russia, that's the third source of gas going to Europe. So where are the European manufacturing powers getting the gas from? From the United States.
The US
There
control.
are tankers being shipped, and sometimes from the Middle East, but that's under American control because there are Arab monarchies that are subordinate to the United States. So by controlling their sources of energy, the United States, and by promoting far-right parties in the European Union, they are able to weaken it and turn it into a kind of insignificant force in world affairs.
And there is a big part of US foreign policy that I've tried to piece together under the in the Trump era, which sees Europe as its almost its main competitor in terms of competition for the running of the West. I mean, and this is in so many small ways. And just look, we started off this show by pointing out we were talking on Wednesday, so if anything happens between now and when people are listening, this is why we don't mention it. But one of the things it has mentioned, of course, is the US, what would you call it, actions in Venezuela, where running out of Latin Americans in the United States to throw in jail, they've gone over to South America to get one to bring absolutely crazy. But Machando, who got the Nobel Peace Prize last year, it's interesting the way she seems to have a lot of support from European leaders, and Trump is therefore sidelining her and saying no support. And what
Because
did that have to do with Europe?
the European leaders do like the idea of democratic elections, and the Maria Corina Machado, the recipient of the Nobel Peace Prize, which is basically worthless now for reasons I can explain if you like, the that would represent a democratic transition. Well, Trump wants a reactionary international of quasi dictators. Right, he wants people like the former president Jair Bolsonaro of Brazil. That's what he wanted. He wants someone like Nayib Bukele of El Salvador. He likes autocrats to drive his reactionary international project forward. in the United States, in Latin America, and in Europe. Now, why is Europe a threat? And why did it need to be subordinated? Because Europe, a single market of 500 million people is a bit larger than the size of the United States consumer market. Its population actually has a higher education than the United States. They have better health care than the United States, so the population is healthier. And if they actually became integrated, they would be an economic competitor to the United States. And if Europe were to be integrated economically with the rest of the Eurasian continent, it would really be a challenge to American dominance. And that's why Europe is a problem, which has to be subordinated, and it is being subordinated now. But as to why the Nobel Peace Prize is irrelevant, there was a time when it was irrelevant. It provided a platform for excluded voices, the powerless, like the Dalai Lama in Tibet. He couldn't enter China, but he could campaign for Tibet, human rights, and so on outside China. Aung San Suu Kyi of Burma couldn't leave Burma, but she was able to campaign and be a symbol of that. It was Rigoberta Menchu of the Guatemala Peace Accords, Bishop Bello and José Ramos Horta of East Timor. They were allowed, because,
And Melbourne's own international campaign to abolish nuclear weapons.
exactly, yes, the International Physicians for the Protection of Human Rights, of Prevention of Nuclear Weapons, right? So that's a pugwash conference which won the Nobel Peace Prize in 1995. The Timorese got it in 1996. And it meant that if you were completely excluded because you were powerless, like Aung San Suu Kyi or the Dalai Lama, and you were outnumbered by powerful forces, you could, in fact, get a hearing on television, the prize gave you a platform. But the Nobel Peace Prize Committee is basically five members of the Norwegian Parliament. These are not moral authorities one should reflexively genuflect before. And so when they started giving as the membership of that committee changed, and they started giving the prize to the European Union or the United Nations or Barack Obama or Kofi Annan or Al Gore, those people did not need any publicity, right? And so the moral force of the Peace Prize was effectively eroded. Now it is useless. Now it is just a vehicle for Norway and its parliament to show their relevance to the United States and its global ambitions.
Oh, I never thought of that. You're doing the Nobel Peace Prize as
Five members of the Norwegian parliament who are voted on by the Norwegian parliament, and those five members decide who gets the Nobel Peace Prize.
and
One
it's
should not just look out of the hood. And there's no reason to genuflect before it, but it has no moral authority at all.
yeah, it's a Norwegian it's analogous to AUKUS, in fact. It's
Well, if for example, Australia's parliament chose five MPs to work out who the Peace Prize recipient would be around the world, you'd find it would be some mainstream figure who would be non-threatening, wouldn't sort of stir the pot. Now, in the late 1980s, early 1990s, there was a more open environment, and you could get the Peace Prize in Norway being awarded to people like, as I said, José Ramos Horta and Bishop Bello of East Timor. At the time, the chair of that Peace Prize committee was the rector of the Lutheran Theological Seminary in Oslo. He was Bishop Gunnar Stålsett. He was a Sápmi. He was indigenous.
Right.
Okay? He was an indigenous Norwegian, a Sápmi, Sami, right? And so they had a sense of solidarity with the oppressed, as a result of which the prize began to be awarded to people like Aung San Suu Kyi, the Dalai Lama, Ramos Horta, Rigoberta Menchu, or the nuclear weapons abolition people. All now it means nothing. Now it is a public relations thing. If you're Al Gore, Barack Obama, the European Union, the United Nations, people who have institutions that have no requirement for a platform, as a result of which the Peace Prize has lost any moral force, and people should acknowledge that.
And to draw the parallels between it as a vehicle to appease the US, just much like Australia's foreign policy is.
That's right. The Peace Prize Committee is five members of the Norwegian Parliament. That's all it is.
Right, Clinton, we're just about run out of time on a Saturday kick-on or a Friday rave.
Yeah, but we did have a question at the very start of the book, Turbulence, which I think we'll have to let people know where they can get it at the end of the show. But it Clinton, you do mention it was written between, I think it was November 2024 and March 2025.
Well, not really. It was written in about the first draft was done in November 24, about 12 days after the in 12 days after the election results came through. But the book itself was written in about 4 weeks in March.
And I guess I think we had a question just about in that feeling like there could be edits every week with the way things are going.
Oh no, the structure of the book is going to be accurate for the next 3 years.
Yes.
Right, okay.
Good to know. We
Okay.
just wanted to know if you, if what you add, or if, because we always have a caveat on a Friday rave that if we are pre-recording, then if something happens between now and then, you know.
No. The book itself, the analysis is been locked in for about 3 years, the entire Trump term.
Yeah.
Look, the whole point of Venezuela is to expel China from the Western Hemisphere. As that's occurring, that the front lines identified in the book will continue. Okay. And what's in the book, turbulence, is going to be right until the next presidential elections.
Yeah, no doubt.
Yes. And we're seeing here a whole different way of. I mean, the US has invaded countries and orchestrated coups and all the rest of it, but it was done slightly different here in Venezuela this time. And it's going to be interesting to look at how this pans out,
Yes.
how it stabilizes itself.
Yes. Well, the book itself is my fourth in 8 years, and it's the fourth time in 8 years that I've actually been on your show. I am not a semi-regular guest at all.
Oh, well, you come. Next time you want to say something. However, I will point out that when I was talking to you on a Zoom meeting about this book,
Sub-Imperial Power.
Sub-Imperial Power, you said it was your last book, you weren't going to write anymore. And I made the comment, yeah, and this will be my last cigarette too.
There's a philosopher named Albert Pacino in a
Yep.
movie called Godfather 3. And he says, "Just when I thought I was out, they pull me back in."
Well, Clinton, any final words before we say thank you and line up a time for you to come back on a Friday
In
rave?
all seriousness, I am grateful for the opportunity because you both, Mercedes and Jacob, have come across as serious people who've asked genuine questions and are serious thinkers about the world. I'm grateful for the opportunity. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Clinton.
Thank you
And
so much. And if people do want to get turbulence, it's any bookseller.
any bookseller. I'd recommend a new international bookshop down in Trades Hall, but that's just me. Okay,
Go and get your public library to get it.
more next week.